This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, June 18th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. For most people, anarchism would simply be a world without rules, chaotic and dangerous. And the people who advocate it is themselves chaotic and dangerous. Author Michael Malice has assembled The Anarchist Handbook, a collection of essays from names you probably know and names you don't, presenting a range of opinions about how the world works and how it ought to work. We spoke earlier this month.
It seems so long ago, Michael, when I hosted you at the Cato Institute and introduced you as the dear author of Dear Reader, the unauthorized biography of Kim Jong-il. That is one point on a spectrum of the kinds of government that we can have, which is dynastic family communism slash dictatorship. And in this new book, you talk about anarchism. And within anarchism, there exists a spectrum. And I think people who are critical of anarchists almost universally are just talking about one specific flavor of anarchist, if I understand some of the writings that you cite here.
Well, it's not even one flavor. It's one imaginary kind of straw man. I wrote the introductory essay in the Anarchist Handbook, and I explain how what are frequently described as criticisms of anarchism are invariably descriptions of the status quo. So it's like anarchism is bad because in an anarchist system, you're going to have these warlords who wage war on people. And it's like, what do you think we have now? So there's many criticisms of anarchism. Some are more coherent than others. But the caricature, which is, I don't know how people get this idea, but they seem to really be insistent on sticking to it. That was one of the reasons I wrote this book. So that, instead when people ask me, how would anarchism resolve this? How would anarchism resolve that and address these various issues? I said, look, the same way if you can say Republican and refer to Jeb Bush and Donald Trump, but to claim that they would have, similar or the same approaches or conclusions for any given issue is simply inaccurate. So the same thing, anarchism being a negation of recognizing hierarchy or authority, depending on what school of anarchism, there are many, many possible responses to common criticisms.
Now, you have selected essays from various historical anarchists, including yourself, I might add, and true to Michael Malice form, you give yourself the last word here.
Well, it's chronological.
That's one way of looking at it, certainly.
Yeah. And also in terms of looks. So the ugly ones are at the beginning, like Josiah Warren. And then you get to hunks like me and Murray Rothbard at the end.
Well, wonderful. And there are a lot of names here that libertarians broadly would recognize. Herbert Spencer, Lysander Spooner, Benjamin Tucker, Tolstoy, Emma Goldman even, David Friedman, Murray Rothbard, John Hasnas. But for the people who call themselves anarchists who are more libertarian adjacent, who are the people that you quote extensively from in this book that they should read that they haven't, that they would find most challenging?
That's a very good question. I would say Bakunin, who was an early communist anarchist. I was very pleased to include his essay from 1867 because there's this idea among libertarian anarchists or anarcho-capitalists, whichever you would prefer, that if push comes to shove, these original communist anarchists, socialist anarchists, would be Stalinists or statists if they had their druthers, that they may speak one thing, but once they got into the halls of power, they would act completely differently. We know that this is in many cases untrue. Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, who were basically partners in crime throughout their lives, literal crime, in many cases, were deported from the United States under the auspices of Woodrow Wilson via J. Edgar Hoover, who was just cutting his teeth on using the state as an implement of oppression. They got sent to Russia. And this is under Lenin. And Emma Goldman went to Lenin's office and denounced him to his face. And the two of them later fled the Soviet Union and both wrote books saying how horrible the Soviet Union is, how this is exactly what we're opposed to. And so that kind of mindset is just kind of edifying to people. Goldman also, there was an essay, which I didn't include in this, in her book, Anarchism and Other Essays, about public education. And you would think, okay, this is the hard question. When it comes to lefties, sure, there'll be anarchists everywhere else. But when it comes to education, we have, and she, in the exact same criticism that someone at Cato would say, would be like, this is exactly what we're against. This is making people ready to be corporate drones. We despise it. But why I specifically say Bakunin, he was an early rival of Marx's for basically being the Pope of communism in the mid-1800s. And his essay from 1867 correctly predicts and denounces what would become the Soviet Union 50 years later. And he goes, look, what you're arguing for, he doesn't have the word, of course, at his disposal, is totalitarianism. This is going to be worse than the Tsar. You're turning an entire population of serfs, into slaves, in the name of the people, in this, you know, dictatorship, the proletariat. This is completely horrible. So when you read his essay, it's just amazing, A, how contemporary it sounds and how prophetic it sounds, but B, the claim, again, that many libertarian anarchists, that these lefties, when push comes to shove, would be, you know, communists. In many cases, that's true, but here's an example of the OG basically saying exactly what you'd want him to say.
Yeah, so I think there are, you know, when you look at, first of all, do you believe that anarchism as a philosophy, as an idea of government or lack thereof, you see that as a spectrum?
Sure. I wouldn't use that term, but yes.
Okay. So with respect to the range of opinion among anarchists, where does Michael Malice fall in general, and why?
I'm an anarchist without adjectives. I think there's something to be gained from every single person in this book and every different school of anarchist thought. Even if, like Louis Ling, who's the cover model, was a terrorist. I mean, he was for violence and dynamite. But there's something to be learned from him, because what I include is after he was sentenced to death for conspiring to commit murder with something he was not involved in the slightest by the state of Illinois in the late 1800s, he stood up in that courtroom and denounced the judge and the police to their face in the most, you know, vituperative terms. So that kind of, you know, virulence and that, you know, staying defiant in the face of certain death, that is certainly something that someone can admire from all political stripes, even though we would find his literal practical views to be, you know, just horrifying.
You make note in your brief essay here, a party platform is a minor matter. War, solely government's purview, is far more serious. Yet in both cases, a vote is a formality, an ex post facto justification for an organization to do whatever it intended to do anyway.
Yeah, I think you and I are probably old enough to remember this. Some young people might not. But when President Bush got elected in 2000, he's inaugurated in January, 9/11 in September. For those 8 months, there was a lot of discussion in the media at the time, are we going to invade Iraq? So it was just regarded as somehow of a something to consider, that it's appropriate or acceptable for a nation to simply invade another nation on the other side of the world to take out someone who was indisputably a horrific, terrible genocidal dictator. So what happens, obviously, 9/11 happens, and they've got their pretext. And the issue became, okay, we're going to, you know, try to get it passed this way. They went to the UN. The UN said no, and they went there anyway. So inevitably, Obamacare is another example of when the population was screaming at the top of their lungs, we don't want this. And they're like, yeah, well, we're going to do it anyway. So democracy and voting often legitimizes these views, but they're going to do what they need to do regardless of whether these positions are popular with the people. And the popularity of the people only serves to keep them in office, but that's also secondary to maintaining the hold on power.
I think my introduction to anarchism was through Robert Anton Wilson, who made significant reference in his various books and quoting various anarchists in his books with their different views of property. And he quoted, I think, Proudhon and Bakunin and others, just giving their very short quotes about property. Property is theft. Property is impossible, and items like that. So when you survey anarchists, in their writings about property. What stands out to you?
What stands out is how this would drive the anarcho-communist crazy, but I'll go there anyway. What stands out, I think, is they have a very dated view of economics and how dynamic economies work. So they were living at a time when you had these mass immigration, people coming to Europe. The conditions in the Lower East Side of Manhattan and such places with tenements, we can all regard retroactively as horrifying. There's a tenement museum in New York, which you could go visit to see how people live. There's a book by Jacob Riis called The Other Half Lives. So when they're agitating for the government to provide basic sanitation, you know, at the time they were being denounced as socialists, both sides were true. And this is something that we can easily kind of wrap our heads around. Now, they weren't really agitating the anarchists specifically for the government to provide this, but their argument was, look, it's unacceptable in a country that has so much that children can't even, you know, use the bathroom or have to be 17 in a room. So I think their view of economics at the time makes a lot more sense than contemporary people in the liberal tradition give them credit for, because their concerns were not invalid, even if their analysis might be wrong. And I think there's a lot to be said historically for leftism by its nature, in terms of worrying about the person who's on the margin, the guy who's in the gutter, and the kid who's just basically been forgotten. And I think that their concern with the working man is something that the contemporary Democratic Party, for example, has almost completely forgotten about, and is something that I think is very American. You know, going back even to the Revolutionary War, when you had Washington's army marching around in newspapers because they didn't have shoes, and then Congress didn't even have the money to appropriate to pay them their due for liberating us from the British. So I think that that is a very easy case to make for their priorities being something that is quite admirable.
And to the extent that the concern is there for people on the margins of society, for at least contemporary Democrats in the U.S., there is no means but the state.
Correct. And the only person who is regarded as marginal is someone whose agenda could be of further use to furthering the state at the given moment. So we look, a great example of this is Britain, where the second party, the left, center-left party, is the Labour Party. And as soon as many of these Labour people started voting for the Tories, in the same way that Reagan had Reagan Democrats, now they're being regarded as racist, white supremacist, and, you know, being ostracized. And it's like, how are you going to call yourself Labour if you're not first and foremost the party of the working man? It's a contradiction on its face. And this shows how, correctly or incorrectly, contemporary leftism has strayed from its historic socialist roots.
So why this book? I can see the appeal in one sense, and it's a very base sort of laziness that I would see in trying to put a book like this together myself, in that a lot of pages are essays by other people.
Sure.
But it's a bit of, a curated book involving a lot of different views of, anarchy, but why is that important right now?
I've been doing a lot of media appearances of late, Rogan, Lex Friedman, other such podcasts, and many people, as I discussed in my introductory essay, we've been taught for decades that anarchism is not really something that we should waste our time discussing, that this is kind of a utopian, or childish philosophy, that it makes no sense. There's never been anarchism, there never can be. So this is something that stoners talk about in college, like, hey man, what if there's like no government? And it's like, okay, let's be grown-ups and let's talk about the realms of the possibility and what is not possible. But as I started, discussing this ideology on various media platforms, people kept bugging me about, well, how would you— they started taking it seriously. How would you resolve the police? What would you look like without prisons? How are we going to get invaded by China tomorrow? And it got to be a lot. And there was a book written in the 60s, which is very hard to find now, called Patterns of Anarchy, which had a collection of historical essays from various schools of thought, but all left of center. They didn't really have— there's Benjamin Tucker in there, but they didn't have the contemporary stuff. So a follower of mine, Marla, I was doing a live stream and she goes, why don't you just do the audiobook of this and point people there? So it's even more lazy than you think. So it's not just a collection of historical curated essays, but it's also so I could stop having to be bugged with these questions and just say, go read the book. And I was shocked and delighted to what extent the reception has happened. It was the top nonfiction book on all of Amazon for a full day. So the only people beating me were a novel and Dr. Seuss. I was third on all of Amazon, first in nonfiction, beating such minor nobodies as Oprah Winfrey or Barack Obama. You may not have heard of them. And that shows that I think people are very hungry, and this is a point Cato makes very frequently and correctly, that this kind of binary Republican Democrat worldview does not at all portray reality, that people do not feel a strong sense of bonding with either of the major political parties. Something's not adding up. And if these are my two, you know, we always talk about the lesser of two evils, but if these are my two choices, neither of these, they seem increasingly obviously cynical and venal. And it's also just interesting, I think, in a podcast era, in a social media era, where people are interested in exploring radical ideas, just in terms of thought experiments. Okay. And what have people thought before? Let's hash this out, because this cookie cutter CNN, you know, Fox News binary we're given does not seem to be at all something that comports to reality.
Michael Malis is author of The Anarchist Handbook. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.